there. I'm Shay Pataja, a certified coach, speaker, and writer. I was born and raised in a small town with very little elbow room. I moved 36 times, started my career in the church, left, spent 15 years in finance, co-hosted a live talk radio show, a successful storytelling event, all the while meeting people in my private coaching practice. But what I love the most out of all of that is people and their stories. And one thing I've learned in my suffering and witnessing the suffering of others is that we become authorities on our pain if we choose to face it. Most of the time, this work is done privately. The purpose of this podcast is to let others share publicly their edge of truth, the point at which they jumped blindly into the unknown and trusted who they were going to become on the other side. So whether you're on a walk, sitting in the car, or simply can't sleep as you suffer alone, this podcast will be here for you as a resource, a collection of conquerors who have found their freedom and hopes that you find yours. Welcome to The Honest Edge. Let's dive in. Welcome. You're listening to the Honest Edge podcast. My name is Shay Pataja. I'm a certified life coach. And today I have the needle in the haystack guests. If you are paying attention to the podcast, you'll see I did not record in March. Partly is that I was looking for the right people and it took a while. Also, if you're paying attention to any of my whereabouts, you'll notice that I wrote a story about my own story and betrayal trauma and how that shaped my life and redirected things for me. In that process of recovery and understanding, I've just been guided to so many cool people in this world that I didn't know existed. I really didn't understand the depths of what betrayal trauma, recovering from that, and trying to understand the world of sex addiction in a culture that has made it actually pretty normal in what I think is a little bit and can be disturbing. So I'm not going to get into my opinions about that. People are all over the spectrum on what that looks like. And today I have Nate and Maggie Blaylock on with me. You actually are not in Michigan. Can you tell everybody where you're at right now?
We are in the great state of South Dakota. We are in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Have you ever been to South Dakota, Shay?
I have once for a mission trip in high school. Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah. So Maggie is, I'm just going to go ahead and read part of your bio here on your website. They are the owners of Known Counseling Services. Maggie is a licensed professional counselor and certified sexual addiction therapist, also known as a CSAT, and currently resides in South Dakota. She also specializes in helping with anxiety and depression, couples with relationship issues, adolescents and young adults, trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, sex addiction and other compulsive behaviors, trauma from betrayal and grief. Nate, her husband, is a certified life and recovery coach. And we just discovered we also have a background in ministry and finance together. So that's a fun discovery. And he has a deep experience in helping others rebuild what may seem broken into something with purpose and beauty. Nate, among other things, specializes in helping couples navigate recovery and habitual behaviors, making meaningful change, addressing relationship challenges, finding life or career purpose, making lasting health changes, and strengthening leadership. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us. We're super excited to be here.
Yeah, we're pumped. I don't know that we've ever been described as a needle in a haystack before. So that's quite the role to live up to. We're excited.
Well, you really are for a couple of reasons, right? So the purpose of this podcast is to have people share their personal process and recovery, which is something that is typically done in private and isn't often public. And by you taking the risk and putting your story out there and quite literally putting your whole lives into your work of telling your story and helping other couples, it's so unique and it's so powerful. And I've listened to your other interviews. So we'll go through that today, but thank you. You are a needle in the haystack because you're willing to talk about it and you're willing to be open. And I really appreciate that. So let's start from the beginning. Give us some context as to how you two met, what your life was like before the moment.
So Maggie and I grew up really, really different in probably most every sense of that word. I grew up in the South. I was a pastor's kid. So grew up in a Christian home, two loving parents that loved me really well. I guess a little bit just about my household. We didn't have a lot of space in our household to talk about hard things. It wasn't anything that I realized until much later in life, but we just really didn't talk about hard things. It just wasn't there. And so it was very much part of that, I think, was just growing up in the church and being a pastor's kid. It was like, eyes are always on us and we always got to have it together. People are watching. But that was kind of the culture of our home. So there wasn't a lot of space when things didn't go well to talk about that. And, you know, one of the places for me, we didn't really talk about sex. We didn't really talk about porn. I mean, those were just never topics that were discussed at all outside of maybe once every couple of years at church, there was a don't do it kind of a conversation.
True love waits, don't do it.
That's right. True love waits. We laugh sometimes. There's a pastor friend of ours that describes the culture he grew up in and I can resonate with as like sex is dirty, nasty, and ugly. So save it for the one you love, which is like, doesn't really make much sense. But that's in hindsight, that's kind of what things were like in my household. So that was kind of at least the household that I grew up in. What, how about you?
Yeah, I grew up quite opposite of that. I grew up in a Northern Catholic home. We were naive when we met and got married, thinking that both of our parents were still married and that we believed in marriage and that that would be like enough. Like, that's all we needed, right? We both did not like, oh, we didn't come from broken homes. We'll be great. And we're Christians. So I got recruited down south to play college golf, naively went to a Baptist university that was just very opposite of any of my upbringing. And I think my parents knew it because my mom kind of really tried to persuade me not to go, but the coach just kept pursuing me. And he caught me on a day in like late April when we'd had a snowstorm and it was like 90 degrees in Alabama. So he just caught me in a weak moment and I said yes and went down. And then we met first day of college and at freshman orientation in a pie eating contest.
And true story.
Then it was kind of history from there. We became besties and about 2 months into college started dating.
So you both came from faith backgrounds. Both your parents were still together. And I think like a lot of us in our early 20s, there's just a lot of assumptions that are made. And I think the church, at least in the 90s, did this maybe a disservice to a lot of evangelicals that if you make these certain right choices, it's a straight arrow from there. How could anything go wrong?
Totally.
And a lot of us signed up for that belief system.
Totally. Yeah. And I think like I grew up in an environment, great parents, they were always around. We did have in common that emotion wasn't really hugely talked about. My parents were always around in proximity, but there was like a little bit of a void of emotion. I just grew up to be tough, kind of the crying will give you something to cry about kind of mentality. And so just was a super strong, tough, independent person. But I had grown up in a country club environment as well and kind of had seen, I just seen wealth. I'd seen a little bit of in the environment I was around, I was aware of infidelity. So then when I went down south and met a great guy and started exploring like a personal relationship with God, I truly thought like, oh yeah, this is all I need. I met a really great guy and we're Christians together. Our marriage will be awesome. It will be easy. It will be awesome. And even in my journal, when I look back, once we fell apart and got into recovery, and even in my journal, it was like, I kept being so confused our first year of marriage. Like, what is going on? I thought, this is not what I thought Christian marriage would look like. I thought it would be easy. I thought it would be free of problems. And we were just so naive.
What was it instead?
Let me back up and hit the ground running with that one a little bit, because I think it'll provide a little bit more context about the dynamic that was present in our relationship. So I think to kind of pick up where I left off a minute ago, because of the culture that I grew up in, I became really, really good at being all things to all people. It was just something that I naturally developed. I watched my dad do it on stage, you know, every weekend or doing speaking at big national events. And so I just became very natural, like always being able to read the room or read the environment and give people what they wanted to see. And I mean, I could look at that today and say, I just didn't know how to be authentic, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, the topic of, you know, sex and sexuality, as I mentioned, was one of those topics that was squarely off limits. But I remember, you know, when I was 13, two really impactful things happened that year for me. One, I felt the call of the ministry as a 13-year-old at whatever that meant. I just felt God's calling on my life. But also that was the first time that I was exposed to porn, pornography, and found some Playboy magazines in my granddad's basement that summer. And so that became, you know, this kind of tension within me of, wow, like I saw this thing, don't know about it, never been educated about it as a 13-year-old boy.
Other than it's bad.
Yeah, other than it's bad for sure. And because it wasn't talked about, there's certainly a pile on of it's bad because nobody's talking about it. I must be the only one who is dealing with this. I mean, again, God wired us to be sexual. And so like there's a 13-year-old kid that feeling all these feelings, but then feeling so much immense shame, not knowing how to share that with anybody. That just became an area that was very much locked in the dark for me and continued to be that.
So you learned to like compartmentalize quickly. This goes here, but not here. And if I keep the two separate, that's how I'll do this.
The perfect way to describe it. Yeah, I'll lock it in this drawer, right? And I'll open the drawer when I want to access it, but then I'll very quickly close it back in the drawer and go back to being, you know.
As well as shame.
Yeah.
Shame was already existent, I think, in the Christian culture around sex.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, that over time for me became, really looking back, a coping mechanism of choice. I mean, I work with clients. I like to say, you know, porn is a pacifier. Mm-hmm. It's a pacifier for something, right? And whether that's stress or anxiety or fear or worry, it just becomes this quick dopamine hit we can do behind closed doors to feel a little bit different. And then again, shut the drawer. So that was just an area that was always locked in the dark, began to grow and grow and grow for me. Again, as a good Christian kid, at times I tried the accountability thing related to that, but it was always like 80% truths, right? Because out of shame, I would never let anybody know the full scope of what was going on. And, you know, as I know now, that doesn't work. So I give that context and can talk a little bit more about how that got more off track for me. But, you know, to jump back to your question, I think that dynamic was very much present early on in marriage, right? Where I was able to give Maggie a part of me, which was very genuine, right? But like, she wasn't getting the whole dresser with all the drawers, right? Like she was seeing, I am very much a people pleaser. That's in my blood and DNA. And so, you know, we met Maggie, I fell in love really quickly and had a great relationship, but it just wasn't built on a foundation of truth or full authenticity. I mean, we were to some degree, but there were a lot of secrets that ended up eventually bubbling out, blowing things up.
I liked how you said that when I get married and I'm in a marriage, this addiction will go away. The secret will go away because I'll be satisfied in my marriage. Can you explain that?
As porn became more and more as I got to be a teenager and then certainly hit college, I mean, I'm dating myself a little, but going to college, getting high-speed internet access, that was a game changer, right? Access to pornography changed, easier to do behind closed doors. So much of that area was constantly there and began to grow and grow and grow and grow. But at the same time, I mean, as a good Christian kid, right? Like I wanted to stop and I would tell myself every time as I was locking it back in the drawer, I'm never going back to that drawer, right? I won't ever go back there again. And, you know, part of doing that was rationalizations I would tell myself with great intent behind them. You know, I'm never going back to that. When I get in a relationship, that'll stop, right? When I get married, this won't be a thing. Cause I thought it was just a sex thing, right? Like I'll have access to sex and that'll fix all of this, you know?
Right.
And so that was always kind of what I told myself.
And you genuinely did try when we were like in the third year of dating, nearly engaged. One of the times that maybe you had put it in the drawer, you had gotten involved with accountability and confided in me because we were close to engagement at that point, that this was a thing and you were working on it. And so I just felt like relieved. You're like, oh, awesome. Good for you. You've got accountability. You're taking steps. I couldn't be more happy with the Christian man I've found, right? And then we get engaged. Then we get engaged. And Nate's dad was diagnosed with terminal cancer and we were actually given weeks to live. We weren't sure if we'd make it to our wedding. And I think that's truly when then at the same time, things were really under the surface falling apart in his life and addiction was escalating. And so when people ask like, well, did you see anything? Like, yeah, I saw that he was different. I asked like, do you need counseling? Do you need help? I
You saw depression.
I saw depression. I saw signs of withdrawal. I saw some little bits and pieces of corrosion in his drive with school, with just things that were like, I saw some of it, but it made sense because his dad was going to die. Well, then his dad was able to battle and give us 5 years.
Wow.
You know, 5 years of waiting for the next scan and wondering. And so it wasn't five healthy years for us. And that was our first 5 years of marriage. The first about 6 months into marriage, I had found pornography on our computer and it was obviously his. And we did some counseling at that point and we read books, but the only books that were out there on this topic in 2005 were, we read a Christian book that was a very common 90s and 2000s Christian book for men. And then there was a wife counterpart book. And that book really made me feel like pray harder and be more sexually responsive. That was poison to me, right? Mm-hmm. It just created so much more shame in me. And I was praying really hard. I was praying really, really hard while he was depressed and I knew things were off. And we did go to counseling and did a few sessions and I unloaded how I felt, which I'm a stuffer of emotions. So that felt great for me. I felt like so good. And he sat and listened and empathized. I mean, the one thing that I can say about Nate that's probably helped us save marriage is that Nate is loving and tender. He did not have like personality disordered traits about him. So when I would cry and come apart, he would lean in and be empathetic and he hated it. And I could feel that he hated it. And I felt like he really genuinely wanted to stop. But I think our problem was we didn't go to anyone who was trained in this arena. So I talked, I unloaded it. He was kind and tender and loving. I felt better. We put devices on our devices, like filters and software. And can you talk a little bit about what that process did for you? Because I felt better and I thought we have fixed this. We have cracked the code.
Yeah.
But we didn't know addiction. Addiction was not a word yet being talked about. Although I was in grad school for counseling, did not tap in, did not have any awareness that this was addiction. Because even in grad school, it was not talked about. Nate could say, this is not about you. This is just how I cope. I still did not have the awareness that it was addiction because the books I read, right? Like, I just need to pray harder, do more. I need to be more sexually responsive. So for me, I just tried to do more.
You absorbed it?
Yeah.
You absorbed it. Okay.
And I felt better, right? Like in the same ways that Maggie did, right? Like I'm now getting to share bits and pieces that I never get to talk about. So that felt good, but there still was an ability to be 100% honest. There were still pockets of secrets, whether it was about the scope or how much, or I just also saw the hurt that was in her. And deep down inside, I went, well, geez, I can never let out the real scope of what's happening, right?
And right.
Because I'll hurt her even more. And so it was this weird combination of like getting some help was a little bit helpful, but mostly really detrimental because we didn't do it the right way. And yeah, we can talk more about that as we as we get into how life fell apart. But
yeah, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to go into that, the tipping point at which you said, this is far beyond what you know, and I need more help than what you know. So we'll be right back. Thank you. Shay here. Have you ever wondered the difference between coaching and counseling? You're not alone. The two professions complement each other frequently. As a coach, I'm working with you, a whole person who has a story which can include varying levels of trauma, addiction, and relationships that are challenging for you. We look at your past because it informs your present patterns, which currently influence how you will choose to move forward. It is oftentimes very therapeutic. A counselor is focused on your emotional healing, which is primarily due to past wounds and a current crisis that interferes with your ability to function day to day. Counselors can also diagnose personality disorders and refer you to medical care. Both professions can obtain specific certifications and practice based on their licensing qualifications and education. Depending on your current goals and desire for growth, both or either can help you. I want to remind you that you are a wonderfully complex human with unique challenges and goals. So you need to get the right professionals on your team to get you from where you are to where you want to go. ultimately, regardless of who you work with, it only works if you do the work. So if you're ready, you can schedule a free discovery session with me. Let's see if we're a match for this season of your life. You can look for it in the show notes. We're back. This is The Honest Edge. I have Nate and Maggie Blaylock with me. We are on Zoom. They are in South Dakota. Maggie is a therapist. Nate is a coach. And today we're talking about betrayal trauma, sex addiction, and recovery. Needle in the haystack. And I like to point out that the art behind you looks like a haystack. So
Kind of does.
Before break, we were talking about the awakening of problems and feeling that you had dealt with it enough in the therapy sessions and putting filters on your devices and sharing just enough to feel like you could move forward. Take me to the second part of the story, the honest edge, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, all throughout that time, I wanted to not look at porn, right? Like I wanted to not go back there, but I developed habits and patterns. You know, what we know now is that, you know, almost 70% of those that struggle with sexual addiction come from homes that have two major components, you know, a rigidness, rules, right? Follow the rules, get in line, and then disengage. There wasn't a lot of feelings to talk about why, when the heart behind the rules. And that was certainly my upbringing. And that didn't see how that dynamic combined with going back over and over to porn and what we know now about just dopamine and dopamine tolerance over time and that bar continually raising. That's why, you know, the video we looked at yesterday didn't hit like it does today. And that was just going on all below the surface. I had no way to put words to that. I didn't have any knowledge to it. I just knew that it's something that I did from time to time. But as most things do when they're in the dark, they continue to grow. And I never let anybody into the full scope of what was happening there. And that's an area for me that, again, as I face some really hard things like my dad's cancer diagnosis and death, that was already my coping mechanism of choice. And it began to grow and grow and grow. And eventually for me, that hit a spot of pornography eventually wasn't enough. And I crossed some lines that I never thought that I would cross, including secret relationships that Maggie had no idea about, text message conversations that turned into full-blown affairs. And we'll never forget March 25th. So we're almost hitting the anniversary here, 2012. We had a knock on the door and somebody had come with some information for Maggie that begun to kind of expose some of the lies that I was keeping. And so they had some information for her and it began to kind of start a process of everything unraveling and me not being able to control things anymore. And life hit rock bottom really, really quickly.
Maggie, can you describe that moment for us?
Yeah, the words sometimes evade me because it was just shocking. I can't explain it other than as a Christ follower, I would say the Holy Spirit kind of was with me in that moment because I can feel like the veil was just taken off of my eyes. And with what little information that I had been given that night, I just, something in my spirit kept saying like, there's more. I just know there's more. And so that night, friends came over because we knew like we were in crisis. So if I called a friend, she came over and then later her husband came and joined and we stayed up all night just questioning Nate, like there's more, it's not, your story isn't making sense. And he would give little droplets of information. And then I'd be like, that just doesn't make sense. You wouldn't be sitting here telling me just about a flirtatious text with a person. Like there's more, what is it? And so we just stayed up all night. Literally all night. I think it was 5 a.m. when we finally stopped talking. And in like a 6-hour span, I just had learned that as far back as to engagement, he had been unfaithful and been, you know, an out of control sexual addict. I think that night he said the words sex addict. He remembered other celebrity stories hitting the news and being like, I remember 2 years ago thinking that's me, but I can cover this. I can stop it. I can conceal it. It will never come out like that.
Yeah. I remember seeing a Tiger Woods when all of his stuff went down with his wife and his spouse and he was going to sexual addiction treatment. Like I remember watching it in my bedroom being like, I'm going to end up there if I don't get off this road.
Yeah.
But of course, all the lies I was telling myself, I can do this. I'll white knuckle it a little harder.
Yeah. So I would say shocking, gut-wrenching. To make matters worse, I had a 4-week-old baby and a 1.5-year-old. You know, the therapy we did made me feel like we were good. And we went on to build our family. And we had jobs that were at the same location. We, like, everything seemed perfect in my world. And then all of a sudden, in one night, a 6-hour period, everything as I thought I knew it was completely different. Because Nate, in affairs, he wasn't like dating people. He wasn't gone and out of the house for hours at a time. These were quick meetups. These were very explainable absences. And then guy trips, friend trips with people I trusted. And so there was people that I knew and loved who were in our life regularly who were involved in some way, shape, or form. And literally, like, it's just not an understatement to say that everything I thought and believed to be true, including friends, best friends, were all of a sudden now not safe people to me. And so I was a mess. And then as the days and weeks went on, I had physical ailments. I dried up immediately. Within 2 days, I couldn't nurse my baby. I had hemorrhaging. I had hair loss. I couldn't sleep. I had a racing mind. And so I think we spent about a month trying to, like, figure things out. And we went to a couple local counselors that were not helpful. They did not know sexual addiction. They literally would look at us and their eyes would, like, pop out of their heads because they just didn't know how to treat this. We got involved with our pastor and another pastor who connected us with a couple who finally said, like, sex addiction's a thing and there's treatment, but the inpatient treatments were, like, life-changing money for us that we couldn't come up with. And throughout that time, I would kept picking holes at Nate's story, like, it doesn't make sense. And mm-hmm. he would tell me more. And this happened for about a month. And there was just what we call now a staggered disclosure where I'd hear it, make sense of it. Okay, you know it all. There's nothing else. And then, like, a week later, I'd be like, wait, but this one thing doesn't make sense. What about that? Or I'd pick holes at the story and I'd get more. And that happened about 3 times. And eventually I just hit my max point of, like, complete rage. I had kind of in my mind a bottom line that if this has happened, and then when it finally was revealed, yep, that one thing had happened, which now looking back was kind of a silly littler detail, right? We're not talking, but you're just in chaos and you don't know. And I raged a whole lot multiple times when these disclosures would happen. I just became like a person I didn't know. I was capable of such anger and breaking things and throwing things and screaming and wailing and sounds I didn't know I could make. But eventually I finally hit my rock bottom in a very harsh bit of rage, told him that I would go drive around for 30 minutes and he could have 30 minutes to get everything he cared about out of the house or I would come back and burn it.
I believed her.
And he did. He left, as he should have.
Yeah.
But that was probably a month in where we hit, like, real rock bottom, like, real, like, we can't fix this. There's no way out for us. And luckily, we also, about that same time, got connected with a CSAT who is based out of Colorado, which is the Certified Sexual Addictions Therapist. There was none in the state of South Dakota where we live now. There was none in Alabama where we were at the time. But I got on the phone with this therapist and she just about, it was like the first validation of, like, this is a thing, we can treat it. Here's how we're going to do it. Right. Mm-hmm. She talked to me about my PTSD symptoms and named them, like, mm-hmm. oh yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. She talked to me about my rage in a very loving, non-shaming way. She talked to me about the staggered disclosures and she told me that we would treat this, that we both needed our own therapy, that we, as a couple, if we wanted to try to save it, we could have what's called a formal therapeutic disclosure, where he, like, sits down and tells me everything. And she talked to me about how we could polygraph it, because at that point, I didn't believe anything. I just didn't believe anything he was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first time, I think, in the journey that I started to feel like, okay, there's a little bit of hope. I didn't know if there was hope for us, but at least some hope that I could at least make sense of what had transpired, because I just was so shocked. I just couldn't wrap my head around it.
I don't think there is a way, right, to wrap your head around it, especially when you feel like a caged animal. That trapped feeling is horrific. So where did you go from there?
I remember when Maggie had her first session with the CSAT.
Actually, I think if the story is truthful, that happened like the night before the final staggered disclosure. And then that next day is when I removed you from the home. Because it was that led to the final disclosure. Sorry, not to backtrack.
But no, it gives context. Important. So I remember when Maggie came home from her first appointment or got off the phone and she said, this is a thing. This sounds like sex addiction. And if we're going to move forward, whether we're going to move forward or not, I'm going to need you to have a formal therapeutic disclosure and you're going to take a polygraph. And
boundary.
For the first,
it was
a healthy boundary. For the first time in my life, I had a panic attack that night because it represented that I knew there was more, right? And I knew that I couldn't control it anymore. Like that boundary forced me to know that I'm going to have to walk through that process and I couldn't hide anymore. And I completely fell apart, you know, and had a panic attack. And yeah, that probably led to leaking some of the last pieces of information and
trying to manage.
Yeah.
And environment.
I quickly after that went out to Colorado and spent a week or two doing just, you know, one-on-one intensive, doing some intensive therapy and understanding what this is and how it got here and what a healing process could look like. Just for me personally, I mean, again, I knew I needed, regardless of what happened to us, I knew that just for me and for our kids, and I wanted to be healthy. So kind of began that work. And over the course of the next, I'd say 60 days, we kind of prepped for a disclosure that was going to be polygraphed. And we walked through that process and it was brutal and it was hard and it was painful and it was unfun. And it was one of the worst things that I can imagine. But at the same time, it provided a foundation that we could rebuild something different on.
The way that I understand it is that the full disclosure is completely necessary in order for the other person to decide whether or not they want to stay in the relationship, because they need to be clear about who the person is, what happened, and make a clear decision.
Yeah. I know with 100% certainty, I could have not stayed had I not had that, nor would I have been able to if I didn't have science to back up his word, because I just didn't trust his word. And there were specific things that I needed to make sure were not present. I mean, everything at that point, like this guy I loved, I did not know. So I had to know, like, are we talking, like, are our children safe? Am I safe? Is there other deeper personality issues that could be like dangerous for us to be engaged in relationship with you? I was that confused. I just did not know who he was or what he was capable of. And there was so much that I had to know that I knew it all. I couldn't spend the rest of my life cycling back to like, well, what about this? Or what about that person? Or what about this one time?
One of the things we say in our practice, and this is exactly what you said, Shay, like it's impossible to heal if we don't know what it is that we're healing from. And Maggie didn't have the opportunity to heal if she didn't know what it is that she was healing from. And so that process was for her, but I don't want to mince words. That process was for me, because I do not believe that I could have gotten fully honest. I would like to think I could, but I do not think that I could have gotten all of the details out that I needed to get out, the scope of what took place. I'm not talking about the dirty details, right? But just the scope of what took place without that boundary of a polygraph. And I was talking about this with a client yesterday. Here's what happens when we have secrets is if I have secrets and Maggie looks at me and says, Nate, I love you. You're an awesome guy. I love you. Where my mind goes is, yeah, but if you only knew. Mm-hmm. Right. So like, I can't even receive the love that she's trying to give me in that moment. And so like, I needed this for me to be able to get out from under these secrets and to say, they're all out and kill the shame that goes along with that. And I didn't know if Maggie would accept me on the other side, but I knew that I needed to do that or I didn't have a chance to be healthy. And so I think the process was for both of us.
So had we not hit a rock bottom moment and had I not held firm boundaries, had I not found a CSAT to give me the validation that this was okay and the right step, we would have probably tried to carry on and not done the right treatment or get the help we needed. I think I would always swirl back in my trauma. I just think it's important that people who are listening to this, if you're a partner of an addict, we just firmly believe that boundaries have to become a feature in your life.
A feature. I like that.
I don't know that I've ever seen a husband get healthy where there hasn't also been boundaries that the wife has put in, right? And I'm using husband and wife generically, right? Because mm-hmm. that can be flawed for mm-hmm. sure.
For sure.
But boundaries are a part of health and healing.
And I think it's important to note that you thought you had done the work, and that's part of the shock of the second wave and the knock at the door with a baby in your arms. It's like, I thought we were doing the work. So it becomes a double blindside. I called it in my article, like getting hit on all four sides of an intersection when you thought it was safe to cross. Yeah. And that whiplash from multiple directions is something that is very difficult to explain. I want to take a moment right now to clarify some things that would be helpful. What is sex addiction? Is it real? And how does the community explain it?
Sex addiction is real. I guess we'll start there.
In our humble and clinical opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we just look at addiction of any kind, there's lots of definitions for addiction, but one of my favorite definitions is going back to something over and over despite rising consequences. That's a good kind of a clinical definition for what happens with addiction. Despite consequences that are there, hurt to ourselves, other people, relationships, continue to go back to something over and over. I mean, if that doesn't fit perfectly to even just porn use at times within a relationship where I knew it hurt Maggie, I knew I didn't want to do it, but I found myself over and over going back to that. And there's a clinical component of dopamine and other addictive features that are there with multiple types of addiction, but sex addiction is no different. We've learned that the studies show that even something like porn paired with masturbation and sexual release light up the brain in the same way and in the same place and to the same degree as something like hard drugs. The parallel to addiction is very real.
Yeah. I think in layman's terms, I would just say with anything, if you don't like that you do it and you tell yourself you're going to stop and then you can't, then that's probably an addictive thing in your life. And that could be a number of things. The World Health Organization has now given a code to compulsive sexual behavior, right? So it's not in the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that we use to give diagnosis to mental health.
But it will be.
But eventually we believe it's trending in that way. And it is a debated thing amongst worldwide professionals. But what we know is our own personal experience that Nate didn't want this. He didn't want to do it. Every time he told himself he was going to stop, it escalated in his life far more than he ever thought it would. And he was compulsive and at times probably couldn't help himself. Now that's not, let me be clear too, because that is not an excuse for bad behavior, right? And there's still consequences. That doesn't rid you of your consequences. If I am on drugs and I murder someone, there are still consequences for that that I will likely have to face. And it's, while it helps give understanding to why or how, there's still consequences that people have to face. So we want to be clear that when we talk about this, it helped me understand it. It helped me detach from it not being that I wasn't good enough or it being my fault, which helped me heal. But we definitely still had to and have throughout life now had to deal with the impacts and the consequences of his addictive behavior and choices, because he made free will choices.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that helps clarify. And I've looked at a few sites that explain sex addiction and it shows brain scans and it's very similar to drug addiction. And I think those who are slipping into one addiction often add others. And so if it starts with alcohol, it can lead to sex. Or if it starts with sex, it leads to drug. I mean, it all ends up becoming a very tangled web that can be hard to pull apart. So the next question I have is it possible for people to heal their marriage and to heal the intimacy within marriage after something like this?
I think in 2012, if you'd asked us that question, we'd have said, we don't know, but we doubt it. Right? Like, there's no way that this is repairable. I mean, I remember sitting that night, one of the last details was still coming out. And I remember saying, if I tell you this thing, you're going to leave. It's done. It's over. If I tell you this last thing, there's no hope. Mm-hmm. And you know, Maggie did leave And she left for a period of time and we separated and she needed to, right? That was part of a boundary that she needed and I needed to face also. But it was so encouraging getting to talk to a CSAT and say, like, there is hope. There is a path. There's a path for health for you two individually. And there's a path together. And it's not easy, but where there's two people willing to do the hard work to work on their relationship, there's hope. Not just hope to like survive, not just hope to like be in this relationship, but we don't like each other and we're fighting all the time. But like hope to get to a place of something different that is open and honest and vulnerable and intimate and the type of marriage that, if we're honest, I think we always wanted, but we just didn't know how to achieve.
Didn't know how to get there.
Yeah. We'll say definitively, like that has been our story. And we're jumping through a lot, I know, to say that. But like over the last 12 years, through a lot of hard work and continuing to put in work, and marriage is hard. Anybody that tells you otherwise is lying to you. Like relationships are hard. Even great relationships are hard. But we've been able to rebuild something on a foundation that's completely different, with rules in the relationship that are completely different. That's something that we would have always wanted, which is something that's real and authentic and intimate, and it's beautiful.
I would say it was a very intense process. We had to travel out of state to be with our therapist. We would do intensives where we would go for like 3 to 5 days.
Yeah, 50 minutes wasn't cutting it at first.
We did, the first one was like a disclosure intensive. Then I think in all, we would go back like yearly or every 6 months and just do like 3 to 5 days. Intense work to heal and save this. We're 12 years in, we do this for a living, and we're still learning new things. Mm. We're still learning things about our own life, healing our own selves, how we relate, how we communicate, our attachment styles, how they interact. There's just on the other side of recovery work and healing the trauma, and me working on my trauma, Nate working on his addictive behaviors and tendencies, and then both of us having some self-care to just slow ourselves down and not be so reactive, like learning coping skills, of course, in the midst of when it happened, right? A 4-week-old and a 1.5-year-old, like raising little humans. We're 12 years in, and I just can't imagine one day playing cards, retired, and still learning and growing and and shaping ourselves into who we're supposed to be. I just don't know that we'll ever like get there, right? It's like just an ever-evolving journey and process of we peel one layer of the onion back on our lives and then they interact and we keep growing and keep doing work. But I say all that just to say for us, it's become a lifestyle, recovery and health. And then that lifestyle is like, sometimes we have great things and then something happens and it's hard. And then, you know, it's like life just takes you up and down, and it's a process and it's a lifestyle and it's not easy, but the intimacy and connection that we have found on the other side of doing recovery work and seeing now our children grow up to be beautiful little teenagers who we actually love to be with and be around in the environment we've created in our home that we can see would have been night and day different had we not done any of this self-work is like all worth every bit of the pain that has been endured. And it's to live a healthy life and connection with people is really a beautiful thing.
It's really encouraging to hear. One therapist described it to me as, when you go through this, the marriage that existed before is completely over. You need to bury that died. And what's going to be reborn is totally different. And are you willing to do the work to create the new reality? Because it's going to be reality regardless. It's going to live with you the rest of your life. Both and. It's not either or. Both and will live with both of you and for the rest of your life. So how are you going to carry that and change the way you carry it and give it purpose? So if couples are coming to the conclusion, and this has come out, it's come to light, what direction do you want to give them as a first step? So I kind of want to go into being able to direct people now.
I think the short answer that I would say, and you may have a different, is find some resources. And the starting point of that is a CSAT. In the same way that, like, if I had a specific health diagnosis, if I had a cancer diagnosis, I wouldn't just go to my general practice doctor, right? Like, I need specialized care to help me with that thing. And so if there's a wonder that things could feel like sexual addiction, or there's been some kind of unwanted behavior that's caused this, hey, I thought things were one way and now I found out there's some way else, that's betrayal trauma, like, find a specialist who can help you with that. And that's a CSAT.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there's a few other trainings as well that are popping into the arena where coaches and just someone who's trained higher up in this arena who can help you. And I think what we learned, while we had great feedback from pastors and they were very helpful to us, they did not know the clinical side. And so while that's been a great healing force in our life as well, we're so beyond thankful for the help we've gotten. I'm also profoundly grateful that they put us in touch with professionals, but not every pastor out there knows this information. And our parents weren't, our family wasn't equipped to help us. Our friends weren't equipped to help us.
No, yeah.
Our pastor gave us some spiritual guidance and direction, but it took a professional who was trained in this arena to direct us. We just wouldn't be married if we hadn't have found the right professional.
Right. And I think that's a really important first step. And understanding, for anyone listening, total transparency and honesty is the only way through. And anytime someone is, like you said, staggering disclosures or trying to manipulate or shape a story that will be a narrative that they feel like they can live with in their mind and that their spouse can live with, that is not doing the work. Yeah. And the only way out is actually, maybe not even through, but to the very bottom. And getting people who know how to pick you back up.
Right. And it's just so important too that people don't try to do that process on their own, because correct, the trained therapists know how to guide the process. They know what's too much information that you maybe can't get out of your brain visually.
Correct.
What's too vague, what's not enough. Like, they're trained in this arena to help with this process of healing.
Thank you.
And that's so, yeah, even to try to do it on your own, we see that a lot. People try to do it on their own, they read it on their own. But if we're honest, what that is manipulating the outcome, manipulating the situation in the story. And we need to get the professional help. Like, no one, okay, I don't want to say no one, very few people would get a cancer diagnosis and be like, it's fine, we're just going to do some sinus nasal rinses on our own and cover it, right? Like, no, you're going to go to a doctor who's trained in oncology and treat, or hear about it. And maybe we might take alternative resources and try, right? But the majority of us are going to deal with that and deal with it with professionals. And
especially stage four, like, this is not.
Yeah. Yeah. When you're in crisis, yeah, you need, you know, it's the ER analogy, right? When you're bleeding out, you can't just wait and
put a butterfly band-aid on it. A
couple weeks out, right? You got to go have some intensive work.
Mm-hmm. And the tricky part, I think, with betrayal trauma is that, you know, gosh, Nate, I wish we had another hour, because I am curious for both of you, actually, you know, what's it like to know that your partner's healing from the thing you did? And how confusing that has to be to get to be revealing things and then comforting. And then, Maggie, for you, how do you get comforted from the person that hurt you? It's very confusing work to do, and relationships are complicated. So
I know there's so much we could say on that, but that's truly why we needed a professional to help. Like, Nate needed to be told, great job, when he hit day 30 of sobriety. Like, great job, you haven't, you know, looked at porn, cheated on your wife, or told a lie. And I wanted to, like, punch his face in. We needed guidance in this, because there was times where I needed my therapist to be like, she can't be the one to do that for you, man. You got to find other resources. You got to find other support. Mm-hmm. You know, I needed to know, like, when to draw a boundary, or when is it just like a hyper reaction from the past? Or we had to be walked hand in hand through that process, I would say, for the first 3 years.
I do want to ask too, I mean, I know with PTSD, right, it creates a compulsion of your thoughts, obsessive compulsive thoughts, and not knowing when is too many questions to ask. And in sex addiction, I would almost say that there's PTSD from the behavior itself that went against your moral code. So both of you are healing from different forms of PTSD at the same time. Am I on the right track with that?
That's very insightful. I mean, again, we both experienced trauma on that day, March 25th, 2012, as somebody who shoved things in compartments their whole life and worried about their image. All of a sudden, when I realized I couldn't hide and everything was out, that was a traumatic experience for me, right? That doesn't minimize at all the fact that what Maggie was experiencing was trauma on a completely different level. But we both needed help walking through this process because it was uniquely difficult. It is uniquely difficult and hard for both of us in a very different way.
I want to end with each of you giving a message. So, Nate, I'd like you to encourage the addict who's afraid to come out. And Maggie, for the person that's recovering and living in a community that also betrayed them, if you can give encouragement on both hands, I think that would be great.
One of the things I said earlier kind of resonates, just this analogy with like what is in the dark usually continues to grow. And I think if you find yourself in a spot where there's secrets and going, there's no way this stuff can ever come out. There's no way to be healthy without it, right? And it's hard and it's difficult, but like there's hope. And I can't tell you how freeing it is to not have secrets. And I was talking to a client yesterday who's just getting into recovery. And he's like, man, I was able to leave my phone on the counter and it just felt wonderful. Like the freedom that comes with that. There's just hope to not live the same way that we've been living. And there's hope for health. And I tell people all the time, I wish I could have gotten here differently. I wish I could go back and make different decisions that would get me here differently and save the hurt to Maggie and so many other people. But I would not trade where I am today for any of it. And that's something that if you're out there and you're struggling or you're continuing to find yourself go back and you wanted to quit, find some help because there's hope out there and there's a chance for freedom. I never would have thought that 12 years ago could say that could be free from porn where it doesn't control my life. But I've been able to find that freedom and there's hope out there.
Thank you.
I would just simulate like the same message, right? There's hope. There's a community of other people who have been through what you've been through, and staying in a relationship because you need them is entrapment. And it's not the same as like, Nate's not here because I need him. He's here because when we're both healthy, we add so much value to each other's lives. I love him and I choose him. Right. And that's not out of a place of need. That's out of a place of like, when we're healthy, we're such a great team. And so get help, lay boundaries, and do it unapologetically.
Thank you so much for telling your story, for being vulnerable, and for being here. I know this podcast is going to find people when they need it the most. And I will link to your website and all the information that you share, including the CSAT information. And maybe we'll do another conversation sometime. I think we need a follow-up, but
yeah,
agree. We'd love to.
It'd be great. All right. Thank you so much. And we'll talk soon.
My name is Shay Pataja. I'm a certified life coach. My 6-month program is called The Holy Shift, and that's for anyone making multiple changes and would like a partner to help them do that. And you can go to my website and see the details there. That's Shay Pataja, SHEAPETAJA.com.